Welcome to the Live Well podcast hosted by the Healthy Campus team of Wellness Services. I'm your host, Liv Taylor, and my pronouns are she, her. I'm a fourth year general science student here at MRU, and I'm also a senior lead peer health educator with the Healthy Campus team. I wanted to acknowledge that we are on Treaty 7 land, and we're excited that you guys are here with us today. The Live Well podcast is a series focused on the voices and experiences of our students, staff, and faculty here at MRU. We intend this series to be conversation-based, informal, and all about the experiences and insights of our Mount Royal community. I am joined today by Dylan Sloan and Alex Cameron to discuss men's mental health and the stigmas and solutions therapy can offer. Thank you guys for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So Dylan, can you start by telling us your pronouns and what program and year that you're in?
He, him. I'm a fifth year psychology major.
Thank you. And Alex, can you tell us your pronouns and explain how you work with men's mental health?
Absolutely. So I use he, him pronouns, and I've been working with men specifically since 2012. In 2012, I started working with Calgary Counseling Center with their program for male victims of domestic abuse. And that was really what started that trend for me and working specifically with men and what their experiences were and emotional distress, et cetera. And through then till now, I've specialized more in working with men and men's mental health in my own private practice and in professional roles as well.
Wow, quite the background. Thank you for sharing. So I just wanted to start off our discussion today with an NCHA statistic. It states that just over one third of cisgender men say that they had received psychological or mental health services at some point in their life. So I know, Dylan, you've said that you have your own personal mental health journey, and I was wondering if you'd be comfortable sharing with us how that journey was for you.
Yeah. Well, I am a psychology major, so I've always been able to read about mental health and learn about it. And I got to take a course in my third year called Effective Communication, where we got to basically counsel other students in class. And that was sort of where I realized that this was what was for me. But then it was actually this past year that I actually went to therapy for the first time. And it was on the recommendation of a friend, just because I think I had something going on. And she just said that it might be beneficial for me to do it. So then I tried it. And I remember the first day that I did it, I was shaking in my chair. I was really, really nervous because I had no clue what to expect. I'd read everything about all this stuff and I'd had my thoughts about it. And I just wasn't sure about it. And then once I got into it, it was really good. And it was still tough to work through. It wasn't easy because I had to think a lot. And my therapist challenged me a lot more than I thought he would. But I grew up in a small country town, an hour north of Calgary. And so we didn't have a lot of options for therapy or that kind of stuff. So we didn't do a lot of talking. Old farmers, they aren't exactly willing to go in and talk to people. But yeah, so I think it was this year that I really started to look into my own mental health a little bit more. I was able to look at it from the outside, but I wasn't able to dive into it really. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I know that you had just said that your location kind of influenced your accessibility to mental health services. So I was also wondering, were there any other barriers that you feel you faced before going to therapy that may have prevented you from going?
I think just worry. A lot of people have certain thoughts about therapy, especially with guys. I've had a lot of guy friends and I grew up playing hockey and stuff, and they were very if someone was going to therapy, they were making fun of that guy because he had to go to therapy, and the rest of them didn't think that you needed to do that, and that was just for people who had something really wrong, and that it wasn't just for people who just need to work out some stuff, right? So I think that was probably a big part of why I was nervous that first day going in, because I was at the point where I was okay, should I just go back home and go do something else, or should I stick it through? And I was texting my friend the whole time. She's like, no, just stay, just do this one and get through it and see if you like it. And if not, then try something else. And yeah.
I'm really glad you had the support of a friend, especially when you were facing all of those societal expectations of what men's mental health should look like. And Alex, I was actually wondering, do you find that these similar societal expectations really influence how men seek healthcare, and kind of what does that look like in your clinical setting?
Absolutely. I think there's two parts. There's the socialization of young men and the lack of sort of, I would dare say, a training or lessons learned about how to effectively express emotion. So that emotional literacy piece, I think, is a huge gap for a lot of folks. And then there is that whole vulnerability piece that comes with that, and going to say, I'm in trouble, or I'm struggling, or I need help. And that's really counter to what we're taught is to be a strong man or a healthy man in society. So it does get in the way of that. And especially, and I really appreciate your story, Dylan, because, you know, I've been on the other side of the table as well, going to therapy myself, and even having been a therapist and then going to therapy thinking, oh yeah, this is a bit nerve wracking. I'm not sure what to expect and how is this going to go? So I think that's a very normal experience for everyone who's gone for that first time. But, you know, how do we start to make it safer for people to go to therapy and then say, put their hand up and say, I'm hurting, I'm struggling, I need some support. And we don't have to know what that support is, but just taking that first step. So I think that stigma of I'm going to be told I'm crazy. I think there's a lot of people that are worried if they're having thoughts of self-harm, that they're going to be put into the hospital for suicidality, et cetera. So there's so many misnomers, I think, that we need to break or interrupt or disrupt and say, like, that's not what it is. And that's actually safe to go.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I actually really like how you mentioned that first step of really admitting to yourself, like, I need help. There may be something going on here that I can't handle by myself. And I know in previous experiences, when I've talked with people I've been in relationships with or just male friends that I have, they've described this feeling of shame, like realizing that, oh, something is wrong with me and I can't handle this by myself, and feeling a lot of shame with that. And I do think that it's important to just define this for our listeners and let them know how we feel about shame. So I have this quote here, and it says, "The feeling of shame can be described as a sense of smallness, worthlessness, and powerlessness in a given situation. It is triggered by a perceived break in one's connectedness to others or to themselves. This is compounded by feeling exposed and worrying about what others think of you. And according to Psychology Today, the best way to heal from shame is to first accept your situation. And to heal from shame and become the person you want to be and build the life you want to live, you first have to accept who you are and where you are right now. And therapy is a great way to bridge that gap and have self-discovery in a safe space, just like you were talking about." So I kind of wanted to go over back to Dylan here. So you said that you have been to therapy, maybe you're still in therapy. How did you feel after going to therapy and really kind of settling into realizing I'm getting the help that I need, I don't have to feel shame about this? What was that like compared to not having that support before?
The first time it was weird walking out of it, but it did feel really good. Because like I'd had stuff that had gone on over the past like 4 years of university that was tough, and I get the understanding of like feeling shame, because you know you can go so long dealing with like these issues or situations that you've had to deal with and you've dealt with them yourself, and then you're going to therapy, and that in your mind you can almost think that like, okay, I can't fix this by myself, and you feel shame because you aren't able to go on your own. But I think after I was able to like get into it, it did feel really good, because I was able to actually like look into these situations that I had a little bit deeper, instead of saying, okay, well, that happened, let's move on and like try and move forward. And that's good. But being able to work through some of that stuff was really good too, and really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And in working through some of that stuff, were there any specific strategies that you can recall that your therapist provided you to help you work through some of the stuff you were struggling with?
There's a few, but the one that I remember mostly was we talked about like coping strategies. And I think like I said, being in psychology for 5 years, I've heard so many coping strategies. I've read some self-help books. I've read different books about like, what can I do to better myself? And there's all those motivational YouTube videos and stuff. And I can like try those, and I'll try it for a week, and then I'll probably be done with it. And it didn't really help me, but it felt good for the time I was doing it. But he taught me like to identify coping strategies that I already have in my life, like healthy ones that I'm doing, and to identify some unhealthy ones. But I think it was, I did a test last semester, and I walked out of it and I thought that I bombed it. And then I like in my like 2 years ago, that would have just like ruined my like month. I would have been thinking about it until I got that grade. But for some reason, I just like thought it's no big deal. It's just one test. Like nothing I can do about it now. I got to go on with my day. And we like identified that as a healthy coping strategy. And I think doing that was probably the best thing, because now I'm able to look at things that I do and say, okay, that's a coping strategy and that's what I'm doing right. And this might be what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you actually talked about not just like the coping strategies that you're using that are beneficial, but also the ones that aren't so beneficial. So I did want to ask you, Alex, are there coping strategies that you see in your practice? You see people using them, but they aren't helping them. Like, what are these negative coping strategies and how can we identify them?
Yeah, for me, there's kind of two parts of like, I'm going to use the word self-care for a moment to, as we talk about coping strategies, because I think there's a difference between escape and distraction and self-care or coping, healthy coping strategies. And the way that I try to work with folks and help to identify them is, where's the one that I feel better after I've engaged in it? So if we think about, like, I'm feeling really stressed, or I'm feeling worried about my grade or something, you know, and I'm like, I'm just going to scroll Instagram for an hour. In that moment, it feels good. I'm distracted. I'm not thinking about it. But after, I don't necessarily feel better. But if I were to talk to somebody I trust, or engage in a healthy activity, or go to the gym and work out or do something like that, afterward, I'm going to actually feel better or more resilient. So to me, that's where that really easy sort of identifier of, is this healthy or is this unhealthy? So less healthy coping strategies would be, you know, anything that's sort of a distraction. So a lot of folks turn to substances, for an example, or anything that allows them to get out of their head. So anything that we would say you can have an addiction to, so that could be gambling, shopping, substances, sex, et cetera. Those things are really unhealthy coping strategies. Those things can also be a part of a healthy lifestyle, but it's when we start to misuse them, when we start to rely on them to feel better, as opposed to something that is more healthy. And, you know, the resilience that you talked about, Dylan, to be able to say, okay, that's okay. I will be okay. That resilience is amazing. And so building that is truly great for you, but also like for you to share with other people, because you also are sort of talking about, like, I've accepted this. This is something that's out of my control. The test is written. The grade is in. I can't change it. I can't go back in time.
Yeah.
So I will be okay. And reminding ourselves that I may be feeling distress, but I will be okay. Because I think sometimes we get caught up in our idea that my feelings are facts, and our feelings are just feelings. You know, they're not truth. They're not something that's factual that's going to mean that if I'm feeling bad, then I am bad, or the outcome's going to be bad. Nope. Like, we need to challenge some of those things. So anyway, that was a long tangent. And
no, I think that's really interesting. I feel like kind of taking a step back to ask yourself that question, like, is this behavior serving me? Is this helping to build the person that I want to be in the future? Those are really tough questions to ask yourself, especially when you're in a space where you don't really feel the best about yourself, and you don't feel like you even have the resources that you need to be the best version of yourself. So I did kind of want to turn the discussion into one of my own curiosities. So I've heard that men often struggle asking for help, or they may ask for help in ways that are not as obvious or well known. And I kind of wanted to turn this back to you for a second, Dylan. I know you said that your friend had kind of almost pushed you to take that step to go to therapy. So how can someone who wants to help, like your friend, be more supportive in helping men take a step towards working on their mental health? What did that look like for you?
Well, I'd always talked about going to therapy because I thought as a psychology major, it would be important for me to actually experience therapy on the other side before I ever got behind the chair and like treated someone. So I'd mentioned it, but I never like taken the time and never thought that it would actually benefit me. And so I think her and I were just talking, and she just sort of, I forget what we were talking about, but we were talking about something that was going on in my life. And she just said, maybe you should go. She said, I just recommend it. She said it might be really good for you to have someone to talk to aside from me. So I think just, I don't know if there's like one way to do it, because I think there's so many different, like, people react so differently. Like, I use my brother, for example, because him and I are very different. Convincing him to go to therapy versus convincing me would be a very different story, because he is very against that. He just wouldn't want to go sit and talk with somebody for an hour. So I think it really depends on the person and your relationship with them. But I think just framing it in a fashion where it's not saying you need to get help, like framing, like, I think it would help to talk to somebody, or said, or maybe you could try talking to somebody, I know this, or yeah, or saying that like you've done it or something along those lines, where it makes it seem less like, I don't know, less like you're going to the hospital to get something fixed, right? Like, because I think that's what a lot of us like view it as, like,
yeah, like very clinical.
Yeah, like I go back to the old farmers, like you try to convince a farmer to go to the hospital to get something fixed. They don't want to go there. So like, you're not going to convince them to go to therapy. So just try and make it not as clinical, mm-hmm. I guess. Like, yeah, I guess that's the way I'd frame it.
Yeah, I think that's really important, especially, I mean, in the clinical aspect. I know for you, Alex, obviously, you work with these people on a regular basis. So is it kind of a similar situation for you? You're seeing that maybe people don't want to go to therapy, or men specifically don't want to go to therapy because they still have that stigma in their own head that this is very clinical, something must be seriously wrong.
I think that's definitely a component of it. I think the other part of it too is the unknown. Mm-hmm. Like what's it going to look like? What am I going to come out of there feeling? Am I going to be worse off? Is someone going to get in my head and dig up some stuff? Am I going to have to talk about my childhood that I don't want to and whatnot? And so I think there is, you know, a lot of trying to think of the right, but fiction around what therapy is when we look at television and movies and we think if we go to a psychiatrist, we lay on a couch, they dig in and we go into these deep seated memories. And it's not necessarily the case. It really is a collaborative process, you know, working with the person saying, what brings you here? What's going on? How can we support you? And it's, you know, two people going in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And so I really liked what Dylan was saying there, because I think even as you say, talking to your friends, I went to therapy and here's my experience, it starts to normalize. Yeah. And it starts to invite people to like, oh, okay, well, maybe that's not so bad. Maybe I can get behind that. And so the more that people understand that it really is a support and an assist, as opposed to I'm going to go in and someone's going to dig around in my brain and find all these things and whatnot, it's not really the case. And there's no wrong way to really do it. You know, you go as it makes sense to you and you check in with yourself and you have conversation with your therapist and this is working or this is not working and give that feedback so that you can figure out how the best work for the two of you and then chart that course together.
Really just battling the stigma there. I feel like internalized and systemic, we do kind of have that expectation, you know, the age old story of men shouldn't cry and men shouldn't show emotion. And it's really disheartening to hear that that's still a stigma and people are still struggling with that. And kind of back to my previous question, how as a society really can we help combat the stigma? What can we say to our listeners? How can we work together to help men feel safer addressing their mental health?
I think asking them about their mental health, asking them how they're feeling, asking about their emotions, normalizing that, allowing space for them to express their feelings. And also, I think going back even further, I might go sort of say, like, as a society, can we teach more emotional literacy to young boys and men? How do I express what I'm feeling? What does anger feel like? What does sadness feel like? How do I know that's what I'm feeling? And how can I find the language to express that? So I think that's a huge component because, you know, I've heard it, someone say that, you know, men are allowed to express four emotions, hungry, happy, horny, and angry. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And so how can we start to amplify that out? And I think that starts earlier, but also when someone is struggling and we see this where I say, hey, how are you today? We expect I'm fine. Mm-hmm. And you? We got to be ready for a real answer if we're going to ask the real
question.
How
are you really?
Yeah. So I might use, say, a friend like, hey, I know that your grandmother passed away. How are you hanging in there? Like and asking a different question, like being really curious and being able to hear it and not feel that you have to fix it. Because I think that's the other part is I may not be the fix, but I'm just that first point of contact. So making it safe for people to express their real emotions and not be shamed by it or feel that they're being dismissed.
I agree. I think even in like my own experiences with significant others, I am very much an over-communicator. I tend to always talk about everything that's going on, every part of my day. So I've always really struggled with that, facing someone who maybe doesn't really want to talk about their problems or doesn't necessarily have the emotional literacy to say how they're feeling. And one of the things I've said to my previous partners is, you don't have to tell me how you're feeling. Like you don't necessarily have to say, well, I'm feeling like crap or I feel super sad. You need to be honest with yourself about how you're feeling. And it's totally okay if you say, I don't want to talk about how I'm feeling right now. But as long as you're being honest with yourself and you're working to identify how you're feeling, doesn't necessarily mean that you have to share it with someone else. I think it's always super beneficial to do that. But I agree, I think that step towards emotional literacy is huge. And I'm surprised we don't teach more emotional literacy to younger children and to people in our classrooms and especially the most vulnerable members of our society. So I'm really hoping we can take a step towards that in the future, definitely. So to wrap this up today, I did just want to say a special thank you to Dylan Sloan and Alex Cameron for joining us today on our discussion about men's mental health. You've been listening to the Live Well podcast. Thank you guys for tuning in. For resources about men's mental health, feel free to check out the links in the episode bio. Or you can call or text the Distress Center, which is a 24-hour crisis line, at 403-266-4357. The Live Well podcast is run by the Healthy Campus team at Mount Royal University. You can find us online at livewell.buzzsprout.com. We are also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. This series is produced by Jesse Bach with the support from the Community Podcast Initiative. Thanks to artist Scott Holmes for our theme. The song is called Feeling Sunny. I'm your host, Liv Taylor, and thank you for listening.